You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 21st, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy spring, everyone.
Bob is out this week because he just had some shoulder surgery, and he's still, I think, shaking off the effects of his anesthesia. But he might join us for science fiction later in the show if he's feeling up to it.
How's he doing?
He's good. Doing great. Yeah, he's fine.
Good. I saw
him last night after the surgery. He's fine. He was, like, basically saying no pain at all yet, but it's coming. And wait, he's got therapy on Monday, and it's going to, you know, therapy, you know,
the therapy is the worst.
Yeah, that'll inflame,
with the shoulder,
it'll inflame the situation. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, yeah, yesterday was the first day of spring, March 20th, and you'd never know it by the weather. We're having, like, our one of our biggest snowstorms of the year right now.
Hopefully my power will go out again.
Yep.
Ooh, I saw that, like, I'm still on the listserv for the City University of New York, even though I haven't gone there in, like, 10 years. And I saw that campus was closed today.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a bummer. It's raining in LA, which means the city is at a standstill because no one can drive in the rain, but not quite the same as a nor'easter.
And it's going to be 30s and 40s for another week, 10 days. I mean, the 10-day forecast, like, it's not going to crack 50. That's crazy for this time of year.
This is really bad.
New England marches of recent years have not been that warm. They've been on the cooler side.
Yep.
We're in this pattern of some sort.
Well, we had like a warm winter and now a cold spring. And we had that last year too.
Mm-hmm.
Winter really got a late start, but then the whole spring was cold. I couldn't plant my garden until like June.
Right?
Oh, wow. It's crazy. I am going to the Amazon rainforest next week. I'm so excited.
So I'm going to go with you.
Yeah, so I won't be on the show, but I will be in warm weather, but also it'll be like warm, wet weather. I was looking and I think the temperatures are in the 80s, but the relative humidity is 90%.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That'll do it.
Yeah. So, but I'm super, super excited. I'm going to help some of the researchers there collect some data. I'm going to interview a bunch of cool guides and researchers, hopefully take some good pictures.
Yeah, send me pictures of birds.
Yes, yes. And you know what I'm going to do, Steve, is I'm going to be recording a lot of audio sounds because I want to try and put together a fun little radio style piece with a lot of natural sounds layered into it. So I think we'll be hearing lots of birds.
Yeah, you could record some Who's That Noisies from there.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, Kara. Oh, my God. What a great idea, Steve.
Of course
so
it's a good idea.
Many sounds. Yes,
yeah, Kara, that
so
would be so
sounds.
Much fun.
I'm so, so, so excited. And my friend, Aaron Pomerantz, shout out to him. He is a researcher at Berkeley. He's working on his PhD right now. I think he just passed his exams for candidacy. Yay.
Sweet.
He is a butterfly researcher, but he also works really hard to produce and work together with a lot of other great researchers. This lab in a backpack where they have a teeny tiny DNA sequencer, which is ultra portable, and they can go out in the field and take samples in the field and like instantly know what species, if they've discovered a new species or, you know, what other species it's close to. It's really incredible. So he said I can help him do some of that sampling too. Maybe we'll discover something new.
That's fun. A butterfly researcher, huh?
I know. Isn't that great?
That's got to be fun.
Yep. Yeah. That was all about the butterfly effect.
You're going to take a long forest bath?
I may take a long forest.
What the hell is that, Steve?
That's the new term for city folks going out into the woods.
They say
forest bath.
Forest bath.
I thought you meant like stand in the rain in the forest for a while.
That's
I'll
the new
that.
Hipster term for going out into the woods.
Hilarious. Well, I will be doing that for sure. Yeah.
As you know, Kara, we live in the woods, right?
Yes. Oh, I definitely know this. Mm-hmm. I've stayed with you guys, and it's like amazing. I say that to Jay all the time. I'm like, you live in the woods. He's like, no, I don't.
Sure
there's
do.
A house right there. I'm like, yeah, but then there's like forest woods. Behind you. Yeah.
Everywhere.
It's so cool.
Everywhere. Yeah, I like it. I like my house kind of not being able to see other houses.
Yeah, we're surrounded entirely on two sides by woods.
I love that.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, I live on concrete after concrete after concrete. My only saving grace is that I butt up against Griffith Park. So it's a 5-minute walk to a trailhead and then I'm like literally in nature, which is really nice.
Yeah, or what passes for nature in a park.
Hey,
yeah.
You stop it. Yes.
What didn't burn to the ground? We have a mountain lion.
There's a mountain lion that lives in my park. That's cool.
That's cool.
What's its
name? P22.
Oh.
For real?
Mm-hmm. He's really famous in L.A. Puma 22. He's the 22nd Puma that was tagged out of the Santa Monica Mountains. And he crossed something like 5 freeways and didn't get hit by a car and ended up in Griffith Park, where his roaming range is really small compared to what a puma should have, but he doesn't seem interested in leaving. He's been there for something like 6 years. He's probably never going to mate. It's not a success story by any stretch because he's probably never going to mate, but he doesn't seem to want to leave. So we assume he has enough mule deer there to support him. And he's just like our resident mountain lion that lives in Griffith.
Neat.
Yeah. And the occasional park goer, you know.
No, yeah, he's never attacked it. Actually, there's never been a confirmed sighting of him because, you know, they're ghost
really?
Cats. They really don't want to be seen.
It's mm-hmm. an urban legend.
I mean, well, luckily, we know he's there because he's wearing a collar.
that's a convenient excuse.
Some squirrel running around with a collar.
Right. That's right, exactly.
Well,
yeah.
We've seen him a lot on camera traps. A lot of scientists have camera traps, but there's never been a confirmed sighting from a person who's been walking around. Also, get this, like once he ate rat poison, which is super depressing, even though people claim that they weren't using it in the area. He must have eaten a rodent or something that had eaten rat poison. And so he got horrible mange, and they saw it on camera trap photos, and the researchers went out and they tranquilized him and they treated him, and then they were able to watch his progress, and he's super healthy now.
So they were able to catch him.
Yeah. They've caught him a few times for different reasons to be That'd able be, to do veterinary treatments and things. But
catch 22.
Catch 22. Yeah. We actually have a day named after him, P22 Day in Los Angeles, that was like decreed by the mayor.
Neat.
We're big fans of our urban wildlife. And speaking of urban wildlife, that was my interior wildlife. Killer just wanted to say hi to you guys.
All right, well, Kara, you're also going to start us off with a what's the word?
Oh, great. Ooh, and this one has to do with wildlife, too. I posted a story, I want to say 2 weeks ago now. Yeah, it was a story from February in the New York Times called Animals Are Losing Their Vagility. And it talks about some of the problems that animals are facing because of human encroachment. And so many people replied after I posted this article just in my, you know, social media feed. Oh my gosh, it's such a great what's the word. I was like, yeah, you're right. It's a great
one.
Yeah,
but Kara, we have no naughty words on what's the word.
I know. Doesn't it sound naughty? I think that's why I love it. Do you guys, have you heard of vagility? I don't think I had before I posted this article. I learned it by reading.
I must have thought someone was mispronouncing a different word.
So. Yeah, me
yes,
too.
Exactly.
So what the hell are we talking here?
And so it's spelled just like it sounds, V-A-G-I-L-I-T-Y. It comes from the noun, or I'm sorry, the adjective is vagile or vagil. You know, depending on your, like, both of them are accepted pronunciations. And the noun is vagility. And it refers to the freedom to move about. So vagile organisms are organisms that can roam freely. And there's actually a related word. It's the antonym of this, and it's sessile or sessile, which means attached at the base or permanently attached to a substrate. So something like a sea sponge is a sessile organism, whereas a deer is a vagile organism. So cool. I love this word.
Is there anything in between those two extremes? Like is something that
there
it's not attached,
is.
But it doesn't move that much, so it's not really vagile?
There probably is, but the word itself, when you think of the root, I mean, I'm sure that there's all sorts of intermediary terms that have developed over the years, but the word, if I did my research correctly, the word vagile, I think came first, and then these things were described around it. So it's really interesting because it comes from the Latin vagus or vagus. I'm not sure how it would have been pronounced. I'm in ancient Latin, but which is strolling, wandering, rambling, and people don't know where it came from. It has an unknown origin, but it's related to the word vague. This like wandering or rambling thought or idea,
yeah,
right, is vague. And so it's really interesting that vagile and vague are related, but do you know what's not related?
No.
At all?
Uh-huh.
Vagina. Vagina has a completely different root.
Well, how about virgin?
I was thinking virgin as well.
Oh, no, virgin wouldn't be.
How about agile or agility?
Agility, yes, definitely. Yes, that has similar roots.
But not
isn't it interesting that the word that we all think about when we think of vigility is vagina?
Well, sure.
And that comes from a root that had to do with like a sheath or a covering, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they don't seem to, they seem to be sort of cognates that were, I don't know what the etymological term is because this is definitely not my area of expertise, but in evolutionary terms, that would be convergent evolution, mm-hmm. vagina and vagility. They did not come from the same place, but they sound quite similar to us.
Right.
So yeah, I love it. I feel like that's one of those words that you can definitely use in your everyday vocabulary because you can talk about – and what the article, the New York Times article, was about how animals are losing their vagility because of freeways. And actually, it relates exactly to what I was saying about P22. Like we have this really bad problem where we have freeways and fencing and stuff, and it's preventing animals from maintaining their necessary range. And what we're doing in Los Angeles, the California Wildlife Federation is spearheading this incredible fundraising attempt, and we've gotten approval from the city, and they've actually moved forward on the process of building it. So they're building a wildlife overpass, which is basically like a freeway for animals. It goes over the freeway, and it's all planted in green space. And study after study show, and it, they have them in other parts of the world, that just various species use it as a highway to connect their roaming space. It improves vigility, not just of larger animals like deer or mountain lions, but you see that small rodents will use it, insects will use it, the birds actually fly over it because they're more comfortable flying over green space. It's incredible.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Neat. Yeah, some people have brought up that idea with respect to the wall on the southern border, you know, mm-hmm. Trump's wall.
Yeah.
And that if you really did completely wall off the southern border between the U.S. and Mexico, that would block the migration of any animals, you know, that would otherwise, you know, pass over that, that
oh,
area.
Yeah, for sure. Like, obviously, we sometimes will name animals for the country where they were discovered or where they have a home habitat, but they don't know borders.
Yeah.
Like, there's no such thing as, like, a Mexican, you know, mouse versus a Texas or Californian mouse. It's the same freaking mouse.
It's based on climate, geographical features, other, you know.
Oh, it's funny because I was looking up the word vagility. One of the papers was, how do we define region of origin in highly vagile animals?
Ooh.
So if they do roam a lot, it may be hard to say this is where they're quote unquote from. You know, this is where they live because they move around. And of course, if you build those pass throughs to let animals migrate across the wall, that will kind of obviate the whole point of the wall, right?
I mean, exactly, because then people can use it too. There.
Unless it's mouse-sized or something.
Unless it's mouse-sized, but that's the thing.
How do they
know it's there, Jay? It's a great question because I was asking the same thing. I was like, how will they know to use this? And they were like, you don't understand. Animals are so good at path of least resistance. They use drainage ditches. They already use construction pass-throughs. They will find any way to not have to go through a bunch of bush and bramble. They want an easy trip. And so if you provide one for them that's lush and green and planted and actually has food sources, they'll use it. And they'll find it and they'll use it. And I don't know, they'll tell their freaking friends. But like
lazy,
they find
lazy
out.
Lazy animals they are.
I know, those jerks.
In Europe, I've seen pictures of they when they build their freeways, modern freeways and things, they'll build these overpasses for animals, which are very vast, very wide, and all green that they can go to and fro as required, not get hit by the traffic and anything. And they're amazing feats of construction.
Yeah, Evan, we call those vigility compensators.
Vigility compensators.
I like it.
I'm going to reach out to Beth Pratt at the National Wildlife Federation and tell her, or Foundation, and tell her, you've been doing it all wrong. Don't call them wildlife crossings. You'll get way more press if you call them vigility compensators.
Oh my gosh.
That's what they would call them in Star Trek anyway. All right, Jay, tell us about NASA's hammer. It's hammer time.
Hammer time.
Yeah. I knew somebody was going to say that. Oh my God. Yeah, details on NASA's Project Hammer Hypervelocity Asteroid Mitigation Mission for Emergency Response.
Mm-hmm.
This was published in the journal Acta Astronautica. And the project was started by NASA and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory to investigate a spacecraft concept in case an asteroid ever threatens the Earth, which is a wonderful idea. Their plan includes diverting or blowing up any threatening asteroids. I think that's pretty obvious. And even though there is a very low probability of this happening over the next few centuries, NASA feels it's worth building a solution just in case. So the facts are that asteroids do pass by the Earth all the time, and most of those that do enter the Earth's atmosphere burn up. And those that make it to the surface of the Earth are typically small and do minimal damage. And every once in a while, you'll see a video on YouTube where, you know, like this green fireball is coming from the sky. Someone catched it on their car dash cam. It's pretty cool. Lights up the sky pretty significantly. But even those don't do much damage. Now, we do know, of course, of events that were terrible that have happened from asteroid impacts. But we haven't had anything like the movies, right? We haven't had, you know, of course, we haven't had like anything that would kill that quarter of the population or worse. However, these asteroids do exist. Now, astronomers discovered asteroid Bennu on September 11th, 1999, and they've been tracking it since then. It's 1,600 feet or 492 meters in diameter. And just to give you an idea, that's a rock taller than the Empire State Building and shaped like a round stone, right? Now, think of that. That is a huge, huge, huge asteroid. It has a 1 in 2,700 chance of impacting the Earth between the years 2,175 and 2,199. NASA has a planned mission to visit Bennu and return samples by 2023. The reason why we want these samples is because we need to know what it's made out of, because that'll help us figure out what to do with it and how to essentially get rid of it or push it out off its current trajectory. If NASA builds Hammer, it would be 9 meters or 30 feet tall. It would weigh 8.8 tons, and it could be used as a ram, or it could be used to deliver a nuke. Mm. The scientists believe that ramming the asteroid to change its course would be the better option, but they caution that they have to ensure that they don't break it into smaller pieces. That would be really bad. You don't want to break it up into, say, 6 or 7 things that can kill the Earth.
Yeah, we all saw Armageddon. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, because it doesn't take much, right, to make a pretty bad impact. Like, it doesn't have to be that big to do a lot of damage, right?
You're right. Yeah, it doesn't. You'd be surprised at how small. It all really depends on velocity and trajectory and all that stuff. But, I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be huge. But bigger than the Empire State Building, you know, something that big could be like, you know, 80 atomic bombs going off at once. You know, it's immensely powerful.
It's like it's what is the question, like 10 a horse-sized duck? Am I mixing them up? Would you rather fight a horse-sized duck or 10, 20, 100 duck-sized horses?
Yeah, I don't know.
Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I would run screaming. I heard that from either situation, Kara. Neither one.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. If like a broken up asteroid into a bunch of small pieces like pummeled the Earth, what would be more destructive?
Generally, that would be.
Then even one really big impact. Interesting.
Well, it depends on how big the big one is, because the big one could do a global reboot. You know, it could crack the mantle and horrible things would come.
Wow.
So NASA has determined that it would take between 34 and 53 of these Hammer missions to get the job done.
Wow.
And Hammer would be launched using NASA's Delta IV heavy rocket. And I hope that in them making that statement that they're not saying that, and it will not be delivered by anything else, because, you know, you want to be able to send the Hammer missions up on any available rockets, especially if we have to send up, you know, a maximum of 53 of them. So they're saying, like, you know, they're not going to do it with one rocket. Like, they'd send a rocket, I think over a 10-year period, they would send a bunch of rockets. And let's say that they were ramming it or detonating a nuke nearby. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just going to try to nudge it. Little nudge, little nudge, little nudge, and little nudge, and get it off of the Earth's trajectory.
Now, if you're able to nudge it further out, you don't need to nudge it as much in order to change the trajectory enough. Right?
That's right, Ev. Yeah, yeah. The farther away, the less you have to push it, right? Because if you make a tiny little bit of a course change, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles away, that could be profoundly different when you finally gets to where it would have intersected with the Earth. It might not be anywhere near the Earth at that point. Yeah, you know, and I just think it's a wonderful thing to have, and we should be at the ready. You know, we should be building these systems and have them available at all times, just in case, you know, they don't see one sneak up on us and we have to do something extreme.
Yeah, tough to convince people holding the purse strings to release that kind of money to, you know, sort of sit on the sidelines and wait for the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a bad idea for NASA to have like 20 or 30 Hammer-type rockets just ready to go, you know, in case we say, oh, this asteroid's going to hit us in a month, and if we launch something right now, we might be able to divert it. But, you know, we really have no lead time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like governmentally, we've never been that good at the whole, like, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure thing.
Got that right, Kara.
We've gotten better at finding these objects.
Absolutely.
This should be a governmental global thing. You know, like,
that'd
come on.
Nice.
All right. Thanks, Jay. So, Evan, a lot of people were watching CBS last week, and they did a report on ESP.
I know.
Did you have a chance to see it?
I did watch it. I know you did as well. I'm not sure if Jay or Kara.
No, I didn't see it.
Invested their 6 minutes in watching this particular report. And as you said, Steve, a recent episode of CBS Sunday Morning, there was that report on ESP, extrasensory perception. Now, here we are. It's 2018. The topic of ESP is not exactly a hot topic these days, and even among skeptical circles. These things, although they never go away, pseudosciences rarely ever fully disappear. But you have to admit that ESP, I think, is somewhat dated. It went through its hot phase, I think, in the 1970s, especially with the rise of Uri Geller touring the world claiming to bend spoons with just his mind. Now, this particular news piece by Aaron Moriarty, who's a veteran of CBS News, as Steve, as you put it, is a complete journalistic fail. And it is everything. And that is it in a nutshell. It's a 6 minute segment, just about 6 minutes. 5 minutes and 40 seconds of it is dedicated to the ESP proponents having their say and being tossed total softball questions by Aaron. And about 20 seconds, I think, of what you would consider skepticism. Speaking of Uri, that's how she opens up the segment. It's a famous spoonbender from the 1970s, and she shows him performing his various psychic parlor tricks. What they probably thought was maybe a little bit of balance to Uri is that they showed him in one clip, a rather infamous clip from the Johnny Carson show, in which he wasn't able to perform that evening. And in some sense, I think they feel that that's some kind of lending balance to that. Okay, so this doesn't work all the time, or even ESPN, you know, is a little bit tricky in this way, in that it's really not a science, that you can't sit down in the laboratory and prove it. But in any case, here's one instance in which maybe it wasn't working for him. Okay, you know, it's really a false perception that they're giving the audience. I mean, this piece was definitely about the promotion of ESP, and there was no skepticism really to be found. And until Sean Carroll showed up in the video, you know, which was nice to see. But I think poor Sean, in a sense, they kind of used him in order to get his 14 seconds of talking, in which, you know, he tries to explain that these things are absolutely testable, and that when tested, they fail under test conditions. But, you know, his point is totally sort of drowned out by the rest of the noise going on as far as what the likes of Dean Radin had to say and Angela Forbes. I mean, these are people whom we know are, you know, have been making careers out of promoting ESP and psychic ability and the paranormal and so many other things. It was just really such a terrible piece.
Not only was it just objectively itself terrible, but it really struck me how old school it was. It was terrible, like, for the 1990s, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It really was, like, almost out of time, because and certainly in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, these were, like, ESP, astrology, Bigfoot. You know, these were UFOs. These were the classic skeptical topics that we addressed, and our biggest bugbear was dealing with credulous media reporting, media and doing this kind of token skepticism crap where they fawn all over the true believer. They have a very brief talking head token skeptic saying, there's no scientific evidence. And then they cut to somebody saying, oh, here's the scientific evidence, making the skeptic look like an idiot. Of course, the skeptic, what they're presenting as evidence is crap, and the skeptic was never told about it or given an opportunity to respond to it. The true believers are given the first and the last word, And the skeptic is really just a foil. And we fought for years against that type of token skepticism, terrible fluff journalism. Then we got to the point of false balance, right? Where they say, okay, we'll give like the skeptics equal time or the scientists. And well, they frame it more as an equal debate. And then we've been making some headway more recently against the whole false balance fallacy when you realize that, you can't put, you know, pseudoscientists up against, you know, the 97%+ of scientific consensus as if these are two equal propositions. Now, obviously, these problems all still exist, but I think we've been making progress with the media. And a lot of it has been because we can blog in real time and tell them how crappy their piece was. And they're starting to feel it. There's been a lot of cases where there's an initial round of mediocre or bad journalistic reporting, and then scientists and skeptics tear it apart, and then the media comes back and goes, "Up, our bad. Here's the real story." In fact, that just recently happened. You know, with the reporting, we didn't have time to address this item, but there was a reports about the twin astronauts. And like one twin.
Yeah.
Like oh, how their DNA changed because he was in space for a year?
Yeah.
Right, right. And so all the outlets saying, yeah, they changed their DNA. And then the scientists are like, ah, no, that's not what happened. It changed. There was a change to the DNA expression, not the DNA
which is
itself.
Like, duh, none of us were surprised by that.
Right. And then some of the outlets actually, like Live Science, published a follow-up that said, you know, wait, we got this story wrong. Here's the correct information.
Mm-hmm, okay.
That wouldn't have happened 15 years ago, right? We would have been stuck with the crappy journalistic reporting. Anyway, so this CBS piece was like, I was reminded of like the early days of our skeptical involvement. We had to deal with this level of crappy reporting. It was old school. And just to give you an example, to emphasize what Evan was saying about like the Johnny Carson show, so they showed that they showed a little bit of the clip from Uri Geller's utter failure on that episode, but they completely misrepresented the significance of that segment. They made it seem like that Geller's ESP was quote unquote unreliable. It's not unreliable. It's non-existent, and that segment showed that because James Randi told Johnny Carson how to foil Geller, assuming that Geller is using the same parlor tricks that Randi knows how to use, and that completely shut him down. Right?
Yeah. Right.
So it's like when you don't allow for cheating for magic tricks, the powers go away. That's because the powers are magic tricks. That's all they are. And that was the real lesson from that segment. And so all of the reporting is similar to that. This assuming the pro-ESP narrative and presenting everything through that lens rather than putting it into the real scientific context. Like, oh yeah, the government studied this for 20 years and then the program was shut down. Yeah, it was shut down because it totally failed. They concluded it was utterly worthless. It was of no value out in the real world. Now, of course, you know, I don't expect a piece like that to get into the detail about statistical significance and p-hacking and all that stuff. That's what the skeptical community is for. But they should at least give a fair, even if superficial, summary of the situation rather than look at all this evidence and, you know, giving Dean Radin the final word on his own research. Oh, please.
That was the hardest thing to endure.
That was
painful.
3 minute,
half of the show, of the segment dedicated to Dean Radin and his ramblings.
So that's, you know, that is showcasing a crank as if he is representative of the science. That is complete failure, a complete failure. That's like failing to use Google. And that's the thing. In this day and age, there is absolutely zero excuse for any self-respecting journalist to do that kind of terrible reporting when a simple Google search will give you all of the information that you need to do at least a halfway decent job of reporting it. Total failure.
Or at least something that is actually a little more balanced than what they were trying to portray in this particular show. And I get, okay, it's Sunday, CBS Sunday Morning. They have a template and a feel of their show, right? I get that. They want to make it fit like with the rest of their programming and stuff. That's fine.
Yeah, I think they did. They made a deliberate decision. I mean, again, they're 30 years behind on the conversation. I mean, literally, this piece that was that exact piece, mainly because they were using a lot of old clips and old data, you literally could have published that 20 years ago. Like, there was no information in that piece that was less than 20 years old. Yeah. That's how bad it was.
That's a great point, Steve. Like,
that's such a bummer. It's like, what are the producers even doing to put that thing together? They could have
So lazy.
Just rehashed something that's already been on air before.
Dean Radin applied a test to Erin Moriarty to see if she had some sort of inner psychic ability to her.
Yeah, apparently, precognition.
Precognition. It's apparently a computer program or something that he wrote. And he determined that based on the dilation of her pupils, she was able to determine 5 seconds before a disturbing picture was about to come up on the screen. Boom, that's it. She has it. She has the power. I'm not even exaggerating or trying to make it sound more ridiculous than it already is. That was it.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is she approached this like a fluff piece. And when journalists determine that something is a fluff piece, that means all the journalistic standards are gone. But that you can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
Like we are not living in that world. And you know, it makes her look like an out-of-touch, obsolete, old-school journalist. Mm-hmm. Because she was. Unfortunately, that's what she was in that piece.
It's a shame.
Okay. Shame. All right, guys. This next item is a little complicated. This is about the perception of free speech.
Oh, boy. Mm-hmm.
And free speech is one of those topics that whenever we bring it up, because there's such a political angle to it, people just lose their mind.
The word free, oh boy. I use that. It's kind of like a red flag for me now. Whenever I see the word free, put an asterisk next to that word.
Yeah,
every time
is
you
this
see
a dog
it,
whistle? Yep. Mm-hmm.
So, but you know, I know we don't like to deal with politics itself, meaning we don't want to inject our own personal politics into the show or into what we talk about. But we do want to talk about how people can take a rational, skeptical, evidence-based approach to important issues, which of course includes political issues. Mm-hmm. So, and this is one of those times when it's really important to just take a deep breath, take a look at the evidence, try to question your own biases, your own ideology. But again, whenever I write or talk about this, this is one of those topics where people have very deeply held opinions. And it's hard to have a conversation about just the evidence. And it's doubly difficult because the evidence here is very complicated and doesn't tell the entire story. So people could look at it and see whatever they want to see. You know, it's one of those situations.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you know, gun violence. Like you could look at the data and see whatever you want to see. Whatever
the limited data.
Yeah, because the data is limited and every piece of evidence has flaws. And anyway, so what's prompting this is a recently published aggregated result of surveys looking at tolerance for different kinds of speech. What caught my attention about it was the fact that it doesn't really – it's not consistent with the standard narratives that are out there. And it's a good – I think it's a good lesson. You know, in first of all, the situation's always more complicated than you think. And don't follow a nice, clean little narrative, especially if it supports your own personal ideology.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure.
Now, we may not have all the evidence we need to have a fully evidence-based opinion, but then you just have to reserve your judgment. Basically, just not believe something just because it feels right, but only when it has good evidence to support it. So the question is, how have attitudes towards free speech been changing over the last 20 or so years? And what demographic groups do those attitudes correlate with? So, Jay, let me ask you, I don't know if you read my post on this, but like, would you say who's more likely to say that they support free speech? A college liberal or a non-college educated conservative?
Wow. Well, I feel like it's a trick question. I mean, I would think it would be the college liberal.
A lot of people think that universities are having the alleged free speech crisis on universities, and that liberals and universities are sort of turning against free speech in favor of social justice issues, right? Like tolerance for oppressed groups.
Yeah, they talk a lot about safe spaces on campus.
Yeah. Trigger warning, safe spaces, all that stuff, right? That's the narrative. The data doesn't tell that story. However, although again, the data, there's only tells a different slice of it, and it depends on what slice you want to look at. But let's go through this. The data that triggered me discussing this issue. So what the surveys did was they first of all had people characterize themselves in terms of being extreme liberal, moderate liberal, independent, moderate conservative, extreme conservative. And then they asked them a number of questions to gauge their abstract support for free speech. And then also they asked questions such as if you learned that someone was about to speak to your community and that this person had these ideas, would you be in favor of, you know, their right to speak in your community? And then they described five different groups, anti-theists, homosexuals, racists, communists, militarists, and anti-American Muslims. That was six.
It's actually, quite a spectrum.
So some of the data included the last one, the anti-American Muslims. By militarist, that's people who think that we don't need democracy and then, in fact, the military should take over the government.
There are people who think that?
Apparently.
Wow.
But the point is, if you knew that somebody advocating military control of the government was going to speak at your university, would you be supportive of their right to do that, right? Mm-hmm. Versus somebody mm-hmm. who is an outed or a known homosexual versus somebody espousing racist ideas like that mm-hmm. you know, African-Americans inherently have a lower IQ than Caucasians mm-hmm. or Europeans. Someone who is a member of the Communist Party, someone who preaches that religion is all evil, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is now aggregated among multiple surveys, and also they showed this trends over many years. And what this data shows is a few things. First of all, tolerance of speech or support of free speech has been overall rising over the last few decades. So the trend is actually getting better. Self-identified extreme liberals are the most supportive ideological group of free speech. College and university education correlates pretty strongly with increased tolerance of free speech. And the single most intolerant group in this data was non-college educated, and the type of speech about which they were most intolerant are the anti-American Muslims.
Yeah.
So okay. mm-hmm. all those data points certainly don't support the standard narrative that these college-educated liberals are attacking free speech on college campuses.
Yeah, but that was never an evidence-based argument, was it?
Yeah.
That's a very emotional argument.
Yes.
From one side of
well,
the
yeah,
spectrum.
It's a narrative. It's an ideological yes. narrative, but that yes. kind of takes on a life of its own, even to the point that I think probably some liberals think, well, yeah, that's true because of reasons that we have or whatever. But yes. it's actually not even true. All right, now let's talk about all the reasons why this data is not definitive.
Okay.
So first of all, it's a survey, right?
Yeah, it has its own problems.
So, right.
Yeah, and so there's always potential confounding factors in a survey because it's not really well controlled. And it always depends on how you ask the question. And then you have to think of every possible way in which other confounding factors might alter the percentage of how people are answering this question. So, for example, it may be possible that college-educated people are more likely to see the intent in these questions than non-college-educated people. In other words, they may see that question and go, ah, they're testing me about my support of free speech, rather than simply using the answer as a way to register your approval or disapproval of the speaker, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
how they see the question may affect how they answer it. Some people have pointed out that the topics are maybe not balanced in that most of the groups that they're asked whether or not they would be tolerant of them are kind of on the liberal end of the spectrum anyway, right? Only the militarists and the racists really would be anti-liberal. And then of those two groups, actually not among the extreme liberals, but among the moderate liberals, support for racist speech actually dipped a little bit in the last couple of years.
Interesting.
So one of the two that you might think are not liberal ideas. But that could further be complicated by the fact that over the same period of time, the percentage of people in college who are African American has been increasing, and they are, as a group, less tolerant of racist speech, which makes mm-hmm. sense. So that's another possible confounding factor. And then, you know, this survey also isn't addressing the behavior of universities, just the the ideas of people, right? So this isn't really addressing what the policies are on college campuses.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And so you might argue that, okay, maybe it's a minority of people who are taking the anti-free speech agenda, but that minority is having a disproportionate effect on the policies. However, there are groups that track that. And in fact, over the last 9 years consecutively, college rules restricting speech have actually been decreasing significantly. So the trend is actually, you know, for the last 9 years, which is, I think, the relevant period of time here, have actually been going in the direction of less restriction of speech on college campuses, not more. Yeah.
Which, in a way, makes sense. We tend to hear about, and the news certainly takes hold of certain incidents, like recently in Berkeley.
Yeah.
What's been going on, and that becomes sort of what America has in mind of what's going on campuses all over the country. There are thousands of campuses all over the country in which things like that are not happening.
Yeah.
Right.
So we get this false sense of it's disproportional. It's a false sense of what's really going on.
And even the things that are happening in Berkeley are really like sensationalized. And there's a lot of narrative that's like a story is told from a very particular point of view, oftentimes in the news, just like we talk about all the time. It's very easy to read news that just reinforces your own preconceived notions.
Exactly. And that's kind of my point when I wrote about this on my blog. And what I want to talk about this here is not so much, you know, exactly what's happening with free speech on college campuses, because it's a very complicated question, but more, you know, why is there a disconnect between the narrative that's out there and the data that we do have? And I think you guys are both correct. It's essentially massive confirmation bias, first of all, and also it's an artifact of the media focusing on the outliers and the extremes and not really giving a representative sampling of what's actually going on out there. So if you have 1,000 college campuses and there's an extreme event that happens at one of them, guess which one is going to make the news?
Exactly.
Right. It's the one extreme example. And if you do go to a university where there is protest against a speaker, an unpopular speaker, who are the media going to go to? They're going to talk to the person making the most noise. The media is attracted to the vocal outliers, the dramatic, sensationalized outliers, not to the representative sampling. And so when we learn about our reality from the media, we get a massively biased sense. And there is a lot of independent research which shows that you basically form your view of the world based upon the media you consume.
And that
people who like, for example, people who watch soap operas think that a much higher percentage of the population are doctors and lawyers than there really is.
Oh, my God. What?
It's true. They think everyone's a doctor or a lawyer.
Do they also think that weird music plays in the background when people fight?
But that's why I think there's such a dramatic difference. Like, you know, if you watch Fox News versus, you know, NPR. So it's just important to recognize how the media distorts your view. And then, of course, now we're dealing with ideologically created echo chambers, which is just even worse than just lazy sensationalistic journalism, where you actually have a curated, you know, exposure to just one ideological point of view.
Yeah.
And so that's another thing, is that when we look at what's going on with, you know, some of these recent trends with free speech, the world is getting more polarized. And so even if you held support for free speech stable, the increased polarization means chances are a more extreme speaker might be coming to your university than would be the case 10 years ago. And in fact, you know, it seems as if extreme speakers are specifically trying to get themselves invited to universities so that they can be protested, right? They're actually provoking episodes that
they
then
want
point
those
to as examples.
Yeah.
Well, and
oh my
also,
gosh, they are basking for it.
Like, we can get really meta with this, because the same constitutional amendment that allows for free speech allows for peaceable protest. That is free speech.
Right, exactly.
Like, that is a function of free speech.
Peaceable protest, yeah. And so one more fact on the data. So again, this study, this survey, aggregated survey, has also, it's not really a criticism, it's been pointed out that this data only goes up to 2014, and that really, if you want to look at the generation who are less tolerant of free speech, you want to look at 2015 and later. And that if you look at those years in other surveys, there is a little bit of a downturn only in the iGen generation, the internet generation. However, the problem is with that data, first of all, that same data shows that support for free speech is still massive. It's still in like the 60 to 70% range. So there's still a strong majority support for all of the principles of free speech in the general and in the particular. And there is this little downturn in the last couple of years, but it's not, the data is way too preliminary to say that if it's an actual trend or not. And so we can't say that this 30-year trend has suddenly turned around because of this recent data that isn't statistically really significant yet. So we have to follow this for more time. And then even still, there's confounding factors there too. So that's the thing, what I've noticed about people writing about this data. There's been this massive online argument about the implication of all of this data. And one trend that I saw is that people only look for confounding factors to dismiss the evidence they don't like. And then they accept the evidence they do like. Where my point is, there's confounding factors for all of it, for all of the data. But, you know, but still, we have to look at the data that we have. And the story that it is telling is at least a lot more complicated than any of the simplistic narratives at either end of the spectrum.
That's for sure.
So, you know, don't just cherry pick the data that seems to support your narrative. It is more complicated. Because whenever you're dealing with what people think and how they feel and everything like that, it's just really, really hard to nail it down. But I think the strong signal is that there is still very strong support for free speech. It's actually, education makes it greater, increases support for free speech. College campuses have been getting better, even by watchdogs on free speech over the last 9 years. That doesn't mean that there aren't issues that we don't have to work out. I don't buy the crisis narrative, but that doesn't mean that there aren't legitimate issues. I think that we are struggling to strike the optimal balance between the free exchange of ideas in arguably the place where there should be the most exchange of ideas on a university or college campus, where students should be exposed to a lot of ideas, but also creating an environment that is conducive to egalitarianism, to scholarship, to the, you know, people feeling comfortable to express themselves and to exchange ideas, and that no group feels as if they are being oppressed or that they are being threatened. And so, you know, having somebody come onto your campus to give a lecture about how your group is less intelligent on average and doesn't belong on a college campus, see that that might be considered a little oppressive.
And
I think also the other thing that gets missed, in my opinion, is that often when addressing issues of who should speak on college campuses, actually the most salient point is not what their ideological view is, but what's their quality. What's the scholarship behind what they're saying? If they're anti-intellectual hacks, I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on. And a lot of these individual cases, that's really the issue. The issue is not that they're conservative or whatever. The issue is that they're anti-intellectual hacks. And they really have no business being on a college, you know, being given the imprimatur of legitimacy that being invited to speak at a prestigious university or college offers.
Yeah, it's this view that somehow just because somebody has a mouth, they should be able to use it anywhere. They should in public spaces, but I've always been really like confused by this idea of like, well, they're not giving him a platform. And it's like, well, they don't have an obligation to give everyone who wants to say something a platform. You can't just walk into like Harvard and be like, I would like to give a talk tomorrow.
Of course. I don't think about how much time in your career, Kara, it took you to establish a platform for
yourself. Yeah. And like, you know, and it's also a big deal. Like when somebody invites me to go to a university to give a talk, there's negotiation about my fee. There's negotiation about the things that come along with it. Like there are people who have a vested interest and who have like raised funds to have these people come talk. So of course they've been in the planning stages and they've decided that this is going to in some way or another improve discourse. Like that's the whole point.
But I do think that at the same time, well, I think it's reasonable to have a quality filter on who you give a platform to on your college campus. I think that it needs to be consistent, and it should happen before they get invited.
Yes, not yes, after.
That would yeah, yes. right.
That makes it a little easier.
And I also think if you are applying a consistent rule to everybody, like you can't make up rules ad hoc because somebody doesn't like what somebody has to say. Mm-hmm. But if you are having like there's a committee, you got to go through the committee and the committee will base decisions on quality and value, not on ideology or whatever. You have some kind of process and then they do get invited by one group, you know, to speak at the college because they passed whatever the process is for that college campus. I don't think you might want to protest what they have to say, and that's fine. That's your free speech too. I do disagree with shouting down speakers because that is
right.
Or violent protest because that is suppressing speech.
Or running up and stealing their notes and their computers.
That's suppressing speech.
That's suppressing speech. Yeah, so there's a line too on that side as well. But of course, that's what gets disproportionately, you know, shown on TV, and that's what people then start talking about is those cases when that happened. So yeah, you go too far on both ends, and I do think there is a nuanced and perfectly reasonable approach that respects free speech, the free exchange of ideas, but also creates an appropriate environment for students on a college campus. There's a balance there that works just fine. And I think most of the time, it's fine. We are there.
And that's sort of like what it means being in college, too. I mean, that's sort of the great and frustrating but wonderful thing about your college years is like you're becoming an adult and you're thinking for yourself. And it's a little bit, you know, dangerous and it's a little bit risky. And I feel like history is battered with this kind of like fascinating, contentious experiences that helped move the conversation forward.
Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Last week, I played this noisy. What do you think, guys?
I mean, it definitely has like a satellite-y, kind of Morse code-y communication vibe to it. Like information is being sent from one place to another. That's what it sounds like to me.
Not bad, Kara.
Okay.
When you play that noisy in the back of my head, I was doing my broadcast announcer voice. Breaking news coming Exactly.
But it wasn't really Morse code-y because it wasn't variable. It seemed very highly repetitive. So it may just be some kind of a signal. I think it's definitely obviously a technological signal, but not one that's transmitting specific information. Maybe just like ranging or location or pinging or whatever.
That's very astute of you, Steve. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so we had some guesses. Nicole Ferrante said it's the beeps transmissions made by the first artificial satellite, Sputnik. Nicole, I played this as a noisy, I guess a couple years ago. That's not it, but that's a good guess. Very interesting. I love satellite noises like that, right? Those like those old school like 50s transmissions. Another listener guest, his name is David Oriole. He said, I think this week's noisy is a DOS-based PC. Someone is at the command prompt and is holding down a key on the keyboard until the PC starts beeping. I've done that many times. That's not correct either. Jim Kelly guest, I think this week's noisy sounds like a number station transmission. Remember the numbers stations transmission?
Sure, yeah. The Lincolnshire Poacher. It was an old noisy we played many, many years ago.
He said one of those secret spy things that transmit data in code.
Right.
That's not correct.
I do love those. I love that they're still using them, too. It's so cool.
Yeah, it's weird, though.
Maybe. It might be cool. Maybe not.
The winner this week, Simon Dick, said, I think this week's noisy is high-speed Morse telegraphy.
Ooh.
This is a cool one.
That was right.
So John Klemsrud last week emailed me this noisy. He said, Jay, I've attached an 18-second WAV file. It's Morse code audio. When slowed, it can be recognized as zeros and ones. When the binary is translated into ASCII English, you get Sierra Golf Uniform, which is SGU, using the phonetic alphabet. Obviously, the sounds will have to be played in its entirety. That was very cool. So that was the SGU in very fast, you know, just binary Morse telegraphy.
Neat.
So that was fun. Thanks, John, for sending that one in. Thanks for everyone that sent in guesses. I'd like to say now I received a Noisy from hundreds of listeners at this point, the same exact Noisy. I don't know where it came out of originally, but there is this Noisy that hundreds of people sent me in about ice going down a hole. Have you guys heard this Noisy?
What? No.
I think so.
Well, now I have to play it. This Noisy was sent in to me by so many people that I thought I would just play it because so many people were interested in it. But here is the Noisy. Did you hear that?
You said that's ice that going down a hole?
Yeah, they made a 90-meter borehole.
Okay.
And they took a chunk of ice and they threw it down. Listen again.
So that's it. So it rattles around the opening a bit, and then but once it hits that perfect spot where it's not hitting anything anymore, phew, you get that zipping but away.
It sounds like I a guess so, blaster, yeah. Like a laser gun or something.
Yeah, totally.
We had a Noisy many years ago in which it was a screw being dropped down a jet engine.
Yeah, I don't know if it was by accident or not.
Right, and it made a similar sort of pattern.
Oh, cool.
Of cascade noises like that. It was really neat.
That's one of my favorite Noisies, by the way. That is a beautiful noise.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. So this week, Roger Fort sent in a really cool Noisy. He recorded this one himself, and I just thought it was provocative. Take a listen. What is that?
Is it like a stun gun charging up or something?
Yeah, I'll give you that, Ev. It definitely has an electrical sound, maybe. Could be right, could be wrong. If you think you know what that is, or if you heard something really cool this week, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jay. All right, we got one email this week. This comes from Tim. The emailer is Tim.
Some call him Tim.
Tim? Tim sent me an email. So we were talking about, Jay was talking about meat, if you remember.
Meat.
And I made the point that, you know, organic farmers sometimes say we have to farm all organically. And then you say, well, we don't have enough manure to farm organically to feed the world.
That.
And they say, well, but if we didn't eat meat, we wouldn't have to grow as much food.
Mm-hmm.
And then
that's massively true, right?
Well, or no. but if we didn't eat meat, where are you going to get the manure from?
Yes, that I remember that too.
Yeah, the numbers just don't work out. Anyway, so I was making that point.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim, for some reason, thought I was equating support for organic farming and being a vegan. And I have no idea where he got that idea from.
Okay, wait, what do you mean? Like he was saying you were saying that being vegan is bad?
That vegans claim that. That vegans
Straw man?
Because it was like, it was probably like a hippy-dippy kind of viewpoint. Like he was like thinking that you were saying, all you hippie vegan
farmers. I said, Tim, I never said that. He listened to the segment again. He's like, you're right. I just overreacted because I'm a vegan and I get a little defensive. Yeah. But then we had a little bit of an exchange, and he did ask me a follow-up question, which I thought we should answer, because one of his points was he doesn't think we spend as much time talking about the evils of the meat industry versus organic farming, which is probably true. But I think the reason for that is because I think that we need to spend so much time talking about the organic lobby is because there is a well-funded misinformation campaign that is the number one disconnect between the public and the science, right? What the public believes and what scientists believe. So yeah, it deserves a lot of attention. Whereas I don't think the same is true on the meat side. And when we do talk about meat, we talk about what the evidence says. And I don't think that we, you know, whitewash it at all. But
I think that maybe the question here, and I want to be a little bit of a proxy just to interact here. It's like, we eat meat. Like, I think across the board. Is that true? Does everybody in the SGU eat meat?
Yes.
So, I'm a carnivore. Like, I'm a yeah, I'm a born and raised Texan and I eat meat. And so I think maybe the argument is that meat is one of our sacred cows because we partake. And it's tough because I do, and this maybe will open up to more things, I do agree that the consumption of meat is not a sustainable practice. And I do agree that the consumption of meat contributes to massive problems with global climate change. Massive. And lots of times when we talk about climate change, we do talk about cars and we talk about pollution and we talk about government inaction and things like that. But we don't often talk about the sort of factory farming industry. But the difference here is that the reason we don't do that is because the factory farming industry isn't out there going, eating meat is great for the environment.
Yeah.
Right. They're not making unscientific claims. So even though I think we're all on the same page that it's really bad for the environment and we struggle with the fact, I mean, I go meatless Mondays. That's my kind of contribution. I know it's not enough. I make up for some of those wrongs, maybe driving electric. I don't know. You know, we all have our things, but we don't rail against it as much because we rail against things that are antithetical to science. And the claims of the organic lobby, are actually antithetical to science.
Kara, right. I agree with you. But more importantly, Bob is finally getting off his ass and is joining us on the show.
Yay, Bob. How you doing?
What's up, kids?
Bob, how you feeling?
How you feeling?
Not too bad. Better than I thought I was going to feel. Every now and then I move in a weird way and it's like, oh, that hurts.
Yeah.
Oh,
no. You know? Are you on medication?
Oh, yeah. Percocet, baby, but I'm not even feeling. I'm not feeling that at all. Kind of.
You're not feeling the Percocet, or you're not feeling the pain.
The Percocet. I'm kind of disappointed.
I don't know. You might be feeling it, Bob. Like, I think it's hard to know how much pain you would be in if you weren't on the Percocet.
Well, that's true.
But you're not feeling loopy.
No, there's no loopiness.
Well, that's good.
That's good. That means you're on a good dose.
I guess it's good.
I mean, Bob, we're talking about meat, and we're actually getting into the meat of the question, pun intended.
Hey.
So Tim says in one of our exchanges, are these statistics accurate? Animal ag negatives, and he gives a list, 80% of antibiotic use, 90% of B12 supplements go to livestock, 91% of deforestation, 51% of greenhouse gas emissions on 20-year timeline, 80% of U.S. water consumption. Thanks for clarifying. So short answer is no, but let me go through those one by one. And
then, are some of them right?
Some of them are sort of right, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone has been tweaked for propaganda purposes.
Sure.
And all right, so let's talk about antibiotics. Let's talk about antibiotics. So first of all, the 80% figure is the one that anti-ag, you know, advocates throw around, and it is based on numbers, but it is not really a confident number. We're uncertain. So they basically took FDA statistics and then came up with that ratio. But even the FDA said you can't really compare these numbers directly, you know, humans to animals. And we really don't know. We don't have one number for how many antibiotics are being given to people. And so.
But we know it's a lot going to animals, right?
But we know it's a lot.
It's still significant.
Yes. So the 80%, we can't be certain about that number, but that's probably not far off. So let's say it's true. Let's say the 80% is true enough. It's a reasonable estimate, acknowledging the uncertainty. So what does that mean though? So first of all, it's not surprising given that how many billions of farm animals there are and, you know, that a lot of them are a lot bigger than people, you know, the cows. It doesn't mean that we're necessarily using more antibiotics in animals than we are in humans. It's just that there are more animals. But anyway, there are two basic uses for antibiotics in farm animals. One is for therapeutic uses, right? They have an infection. They take antibiotics. And the other is non-therapeutic uses, where antibiotics are used to increase the growth rate of farm animals. Now, the non-therapeutic antibiotics used in animals are not the same antibiotics used in people. So there is no issue in terms of antibiotic resistance from the non-therapeutic use. But there,
and also we're seeing a big change in that. Like there, more and more companies are signing on not to do that anymore.
Yes, that's correct. And in terms of the therapeutic use, there is overlap. So we do use some of the same antibiotics in farm animals as we use in people, and it does contribute to antibiotic resistance in bacteria. And so there is, as you say, Kara, I agree with that. That's an issue. It is contributing to antibiotic resistance in people. There is pressure for the practices in the animal agricultural industry to use less and less antibiotics. It is happening, but it needs to happen more. And again, there I think the solution is there's better practices would help that issue. It's not absolutely necessary, but it is, you know, to use antibiotics the way they're at the level they're currently being used. However, I would also say there's a misconception that if you eat meat of animals that were treated with antibiotics, there'll be antibiotics in the meat. And that is just not true, because you can't slaughter an animal for human consumption within a certain period of time after they've received antibiotics. So they always give that enough time for the antibiotics to be out of the animal system before they'll slaughter it for the meat. So so that's just part, that's already built into the regulation.
That's good. Process. Good.
I do have, if you're interested in reading some good evidence-based journalism about this, I highly recommend a great book by Maren McKenna, and maybe we should have her on the show.
Sure.
Yeah, she originally wrote a book called Superbug, all about MRSA. She was an embedded journalist at the CDC, and her newest book is called Big Chicken, and it's all about antibiotic resistance in the sort of farm industry, especially the, what do you call it, factory farming industry. Yeah. And she is a really good science-based journalist, so it could be an interesting chat.
Yeah.
Read
all
the
right, book. Let's go to number two, B12. 90% of B12 supplements go to livestock. I actually couldn't vet that figure. I don't know where it came from. I mean, I've seen people repeating it, but I couldn't track it back to some kind of primary source. But my answer to that one is, who cares? I'm not sure why we care that we're giving B12 supplements to animals, right?
B12 doesn't contribute to any problems.
What's the downside? No, it's good for them. They need the B12. The reason why we have to do that is because they're not getting enough of it from the grass that they're grazing on.
Yeah. And that's is there a problem with B12 in the water table?
No, it's not an issue.
Yeah, I don't know.
No. The problem is there's not enough cobalt in the soil, and that's where the B12 comes from, and so we have to basically just give them supplements. So
cobalt, the stuff that makes things blue?
Yeah.
Weird.
It's a trace mineral. But anyway, so I'm not sure why anybody should care about that. That's my unless I'm missing something.
I'm sure we'll get an email response.
Right.
Let me know. I couldn't find out. I couldn't find any downside to it. It just sounds like they're just trying to inflate the scary numbers. You know, 90% of B12 supplements.
Oh my gosh, we need those.
Gosh, letters and numbers. Must be bad.
So 91% of deforestation. I also could not validate that figure. That seems massively inflated.
Uh-huh. What's the full figure? What is it?
91% of deforestation. But I think the answer
from
there
farming.
Is
we animals.
Shouldn't
wow.
We shouldn't be cutting down our forests.
Right.
I think we definitely want to reduce the footprint of how much land we use for farming.
Oh, yeah.
No question about that.
The problem is the ethics of that. Like, that's where a lot of the arguments come in, that the less space we use, if we still have to produce the same amount of food, that is what leads to some of the kind of unethical conditions, the inhumane conditions of factory farming.
Right. I'll get more to all of that at the end. But
oh, okay, cool.
Let's just say that that's why we want to have efficient agriculture to use less land. I totally agree that that's a priority. We have been producing more per acre over the last 100 years, and we want to continue that trend with ethical practices, of course, but that is definitely the answer. Okay, greenhouse gases. So I think that 51% figure is just flat out wrong. Multiple sources that I found, primary sources, you know, reliable sources, say essentially that animal agriculture is responsible for 14 to 18% of the greenhouse gas emissions, not 51%. And you could look at it. You could look at it from the perspective of how much of the climate forcing comes from animal agriculture, and that is estimated to be about 20%.
This climate is forcing, that's directly contributing to the increase in the temperature.
So, 20% of the increase in temperature is due to the methane from animals, from farm animals. Mm-hmm. Here's how I think they get to the 51% figure. You'll notice he says on a 20-year timeline. Why a 20-year timeline? That's not arbitrary. Mm-hmm. It's because methane has its effect over 20 years, while carbon dioxide has its effect over 100 years. So if you look at the 20-year timeline, you are massively biasing the comparison towards methane and away from carbon dioxide. So that's just fake. That's just playing with the numbers to inflate that.
There's nothing about methane actually being a more potent greenhouse gas.
It is. It is. There's a lot less of it, but it's a lot more potent per volume. Okay. But this is just looking at the total effect, right? The total effect. It's still 20%. But it also is, it's important to note that this is a short-term effect, you know, relatively speaking, that methane is not stable in the atmosphere. It gets used up and it does have its effect over about 20 years. So there really is more of a steady state of methane in the atmosphere. And that has been definitely increasing. Obviously, the more animals farting we have, the more, the higher the steady state of methane in the atmosphere is going to be. And that is contributing to it, but it isn't really as dangerous as carbon, because once carbon gets in the carbon cycle, it's pretty much there for the long term, at least 100 years. So the overall effect of that carbon is going to be more, because it's going to be hanging out for a lot longer.
There we're talking about it like being absorbed by the ocean or actually being sequestered in places.
Okay. Yes. And and there are things you can do to sort of capture that methane from animals. You know what I mean? Especially if you have, you know, animals in a small area, you can capture the methane and then burn it as fuel rather than just releasing it into the atmosphere. So that could mitigate that to some extent.
It's a raw material for some for some industries. And so, because a lot of that methane is not from them farting, it's coming off of the manure piles, and so you can actually do these like venting systems where you just capture all this methane, which is a super valuable gas.
Right. Exactly. So, so the 51% is an artificial number for propaganda purposes. I think 20% is probably the best figure, because that's the amount of forcing that is due to animal agriculture. And that can be mitigated more than it is currently. And it's also more short-term and long-term for the carbon. Okay, let's get to water. 80% of U.S. water consumption. So that's not true at all. It's 80% of all agriculture. I mean, all of agriculture uses up 80% of water supplies in the U.S., 70% globally.
So just a little misleading there.
And
so what percent of the agriculture does it make up of?
So 36% of crop calories are used for animal feed. Mm-hmm. So basically a third of that water use is for animals.
Okay. So it's not 80 – wait, you said agriculture makes up 80% of the overall
all of
water
agriculture,
use?
All of agriculture.
So we'd have to divide that 80% by three to animal farming is. Okay, so that's a lot less. I mean, it's still significant. It's still significant, but it's
not 80% of all water use.
And water is supposed to water our food. Like that, we do need. That's a big use of it.
All right, but let's talk about that figure. So 36% of crop calories are used for animal feed, 55% for direct human consumption, 9% for biofuels and other uses. So that's also the point that when, you know, we talk about land use for growing crops, we go, but a lot of that is going to animals. Well, it's actually only 36%, which is still, it's a significant chunk, but it's not the majority of it. Let's talk about what would happen if the world went vegan or vegetarian. Right. That's basically what we're talking about here. We're trying to infer that from all these numbers. One other piece of information we need in order to answer that question is what is the feed conversion ratio for different animals? So how many calories does an animal eat over their lifetime, and how many calories do we get out of that animal when we slaughter it? And so it's a ratio, right? So if it's 2-1, that means you have to feed that animal twice as many calories as you get out of it from the meat. So for beef, it's 4.5 to 7.5. This depends upon the practices, the efficiency, where the calories are coming from.
It's actually lower than I thought.
Yeah, it's lower than I thought too, but it's 4.5 to 7.5. For dairy's the worst, 8 to 13.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love dairy.
Are in milk, of course. Mm-hmm. For
You think that's mostly milk? What if we just cut milk, but we got to keep our cheese?
Well, it's still dairy, yeah.
That's very important to me.
Yes. All right, pigs, 3.8 to 4.5.
Pigs.
Sheep, 4 to 6. Poultry, 1.6 to 1.8. That's not bad.
Wow.
No.
Did you look up lamb?
Lamb can be bad. Lamb could be up to like 30 or 40.
Like a lot of people eat lamb and it's not great for the environment.
It's the worst one of the meats. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then crickets, for some reason, crickets was on the list, 1.7.
Oh, yeah, because a lot of people want to move to cricket protein. Yeah.
Fish is complicated because you end up feeding fish to fish, but fish is like 1 to 1.5. So it's actually the best.
Yeah. But fish is also a tough thing because we don't only eat farmed fish. We also eat a lot of
caught
fish. We overfish the oceans. Yeah, yes. So that's a whole
That's why I said fish is complicated, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're just looking at feed conversion ratio, it's pretty low. And rabbit is 2.5 to 3, so middling. Oh. So, you know, poultry, though, is not bad. 1.6 no. to 1.8, it's less than 2 to 1. It's not real. And really, it's beef. Beef is the big thing. Beef, lamb. We don't eat a lot of lamb in the U.S. But even sheep are not great, 4 to 6. Mm-hmm. Pigs are not 3.8 to 4.5. Yeah, they're not horrible, but they're not great either. So if we if we stuck mostly to poultry and fish and crickets, we'd be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I could do the poultry part of that. I'm good.
Yeah, I do that already. I really do.
Most of, I'm chicken all day.
So some people actually did – they did a computer progress simulation to say what would happen if we tried to convert the entire world to a vegetarian or a vegan diet.
Oh, cool. Hmm.
Cool.
So they said that we would decrease food-related greenhouse gases by 60%. Right? It wouldn't eliminate the food-related greenhouse gases, but it would reduce it by 60%.
Okay.
Yeah, because growing plants still requires you know, large equipment, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Now, 68% of agricultural land is used for livestock. 68%.
Wow.
That's a lot. However, that's mostly for grazing, not for growing crops. And most of that land where they're grazing would not be suitable for crops. Yeah. Right.
But it would be suitable for natural habitat again. And I think that's the thing.
Yes. As I was about to say, that what you would do with it is convert it over to natural habitat.
Yeah.
However, here's the problem. So the most of the advantages, environmentally and health-wise for that matter, would go to Western developed countries at the expense of the developing world would take a massive hit. And here's why.
Wow.
Because the developing world disproportionately lives in parts of the world that are semi-arid or arid. And those lands do not support crops, but they can support grazing. So they are really dependent on grazing animals for their calories because meat is also very calorie dense. They basically could not survive growing crops.
Yeah. But here's an interesting conversation to be had, right? Because if you actually were to compare the per capita, we eat way more meat in the United States.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so if maybe just the same people, the Westerners, reduce their meat consumption without having this finger-wagging colonial, you guys should too.
I agree. So here is where the article where I got this data from, you know, where they wound up, and I agree. And they said, essentially, you can have the best of both worlds by reducing but not completely eliminating meat consumption. Mm-hmm. And you should balance it better throughout the world. So obviously, parts of the world that are semi-arid and need grazing to support their calories, there's no reason to tell them to stop, right? That's just insane. But for the Western world, we consume way more meat than we probably should for our health, than is sustainable environmentally. And we way disproportionately consume meat just per capita, just compared to the whole world. And so there definitely is room for us to significantly reduce our meat consumption. And I agree with that. I totally agree with that. And in fact, I, over the last 5 or so years, I've been significantly decreasing the amount of meat total that I eat, but especially beef. Beef for my family is an occasional treat, like once or twice a month. And then most of the meat we consume are chicken. My wife loves fish. I hate fish, but, so she eats fish almost every time we go out because we never cook it at home. But I just have a lot. When I do eat meat, most of the time I'm eating chicken. Very rarely have any pig-based meat, but we occasionally do, but very rarely.
Do you think that's also contributed to some of your weight loss recently?
No, that's just – I'm just –
because that was more conscious decision
about
calories.
That's all portion size.
Yeah.
Because I didn't change. I did not make a change when I started losing weight. That was just all – in terms of what I was eating, the only change I made was the portion size. But anyway, and I do eat lots of all vegetable meals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically I don't think I eat any meat for breakfast or lunch. So it's only dinner. And then most of that is, you know, we have pasta a couple times a week. That's all, you know, that's meatless. We have salad, you know, once every week or two. We have, there are vegetarian dishes that we eat, or we have dishes with a little bit of chicken in them, but they're mostly vegetables. Like tonight we had a chicken stir fry, but it was 90% vegetable. You know what I mean?
I want chicken stir fry. That sounds good.
Oh, it was awesome. No. Yeah, I made it with this good stir fry sauce, and there was I tried this. We had these snap peas, broccoli, the water chestnuts, and for the first time, I used this butternut squash, which was cut into like these noodle shapes.
Yeah, we do that all the time at home. I love it.
Yeah, I chopped them up and I stir fried it up. It was awesome.
Yeah, could eat that all day.
Thanks
long.
For inviting me over.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I agree that we should be reducing our overall meat consumption. We actually didn't specifically mention the health effects. And here's the thing. My reading of all the literature is that probably the optimal diet for health is to have a little bit of meat. And I've been saying this for years. Your diet should be varied, but be mostly plants, but not 100%. It's really hard to get all the nutrients you need with no meat. I'm not saying you can't, absolutely can't do it. There are people who can do it, but it's hard. And I see a lot of patients, for example, who are vegetarian, who are B12 deficient or who have other vitamin deficiencies because they're not quite pulling it off. And there is published evidence that people who have some meat in their diet are healthier than people who have zero meat in their diet.
Whoa.
So I do think that, again, like I was discussing earlier in the evening, the data is complicated, and you know, you could, if you want to cherry pick and make whatever case you can, you probably could. But all I'm saying is, if you look at all the data, I think the consensus is that the best diet for your health is to have mostly plants, but a little meat. Yeah. And there certainly is no downside to having a little meat. The only health problems come in when you have a lot of meat, when you have a very meat-heavy diet. And there's no question that that's bad for you.
Yeah, and I mean, it would be interesting to see that same study if they had run the numbers, if the average meat consumption in developed countries were significantly lower than it is, but still there.
If we cut our meat eating in half, let's say, that would probably be a good approximation of where we should be, something like that. And we got into this conversation because Jay was talking about the lab-grown meat, so we still need to see how that's going to influence all of this. And also micro-farming, like the crickets again.
Yep.
I think that will be a tremendous source of animal protein in the future is insects.
It's going to have to be. I mean, at a certain point, we're going to be forced to eat that way. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, so
let's get ready.
Maybe not.
We'll see.
And there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, you know, just another source of protein. It all gets, you know.
Can I have some tofu instead of, you know?
What?
No, honestly, have you ever tried cricket flour, Evan?
No.
The thing is, I agree when you can taste the legs and the antennas, like it's a textural thing for me. I've eaten a lot of bugs over
the
years. Yeah. But cricket flour, you can't because it's ground up. You would not know the difference. It tastes the exact same as flour.
Well, is it? There's protein.
Yeah, it's really high in protein. It's great. It's actually quite good for you. But there are ways to eat bugs that they become like a sort of a substrate. Yeah. Like there are ways to eat processed bugs where it's much easier for a lot of people than eating whole bugs. But then again, this is another Western bias because, you know, people eat bugs in a lot of the world and it's a common way to eat food.
If I want my daily recommended allowance of bugs, I'll just eat a hot dog.
You can do that because that's true. You actually have eaten a lot of bugs.
So,
is this why you pulled me off my healing couch to talk about eating bugs?
No, Bob, I pulled you off the healing couch because of science or fiction, which we're getting to right now.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
All right.
Maybe.
Here we go. Item number one, scientists report the first discovery of a mutation in non-functional junk DNA linked to an inherited disease. Item number two, by using a filter designed for car exhaust, scientists have reduced the carcinogens and improved the taste of smoked foods. And item number three, in a recent survey, 21% of respondents reported experiencing visual auditory synesthesia. Bob, why don't you go first so you can answer these before you pass out from your...
I'm fine. I'm good. I don't need to go first. I'm okay. I think Jay hasn't gone in a while.
Well, then, just as a courtesy, you could go first.
Oh, wait. Since when are you courteous to me? All right. Let's see.
Since you just had surgery.
Okay, thank you. The first one, that's pretty cool. A mutation in non-functional junk DNA that's actually linked to an inherited disease. Wow. That's cool and scary. You know, a little skeptical, though. I mean, it's non-functional for a reason, but I guess that's what a mutation can do. So let's say look at number two here. A filter designed for car exhaust. Cooking, you're smoking food using car exhaust, but it's got a filter on it, so it's okay? Is that what you're saying?
No. You're putting a filter that that people use on car exhaust on your food smoker.
designed for cars. Yeah, I always miss a keyword.
So dope, dude.
All right. Improve the taste, reduce the carcinogens, and improve the taste. I don't know. I think carcinogens can be quite tasty, so I'm not buying that one either. Let's look at the third one. In research, 21% of respondents reported experiencing, 21% of people are synesthetes? I don't think so. So basically, they're all false. Okay, I'm done. all right, let's go with the carcinogens. I'm kind of buying that. So look, we'll go junk DNA, fake.
Okay, Evan?
Linked to an inherited disease. Wow, a mutation in non-functional junk DNA. How is that possible? Doesn't that automatically take it out of the junk DNA category at that point?
Yes.
If it's linked to an inherited disease? I mean, my understanding of the technical definition of junk DNA is probably not right. So that's why that one's throwing me for a loop. Regarding the filter designed for car exhaust, really has nothing to do with car exhaust. It has to do with the filter. It reduces carcinogens and improves the taste of smoked foods. I recently got a copper sheet for my grill.
That's right, copper.
I like it. And that's just a piece of copper. So I don't know. I suppose you could have a filter that would reduce the carcinogens, improve the taste of smoked foods. Well, you know, I mean, that's a bit subjective right there when you're talking about taste. That might be the problem with that one. And then the 21% of respondents reported experiencing visual auditory synesthesia. Well, maybe they responded, but they don't really know what visual auditory synesthesia is. I mean, perhaps, right? I mean, do they have a clear working definition of what that exactly is?
Yeah, let's assume they made sure that they knew what it meant.
Okay, you know? All right, so it's not some skewed number because of that. Well, then I think it's this junk DNA one. I don't understand it. How could that possibly be a mutation in junk DNA that linked to an inherited disease? I don't see it. I'm going to go with Bob, even though he's on Percocet.
Okay, Kara.
I might have to go with the group, although the car exhaust one is bugging me too. I feel like the synesthete one I get because, again, Bob hit the nail on the head when he said, you know, they reported experiencing visual auditory synesthesia. They may have reported experiencing it one time. And I think that actually synesthesia is broader than we ever gave it credit for in the past because we tend to describe it in a really narrow way.
Like, such a blue thing to say.
Yeah. But we do. We're like, oh, the calendar has music attached to it. I don't ever experience that. And it's like, no, but maybe sometimes you see something and there's a tonal quality to it, or you hear something, a certain noise, and you have a visual kind of response to it. Like there may be vaguer experiences of synesthesia that are much more common. So I think that one's probably science. The car exhaust one bugs me because just like Bob said, I feel like the things that make the meat have more carcinogens is what also makes it taste good. Like the blackening aspect of smoking and cooking and grilling meat is what makes it so delicious. And if you don't do that anymore, then I don't know. But maybe I'm wrong, and maybe there's a way to get that taste without all the carcinogens. But the non-coding DNA one bugs me, not because I think that there's probably not important stuff to be found in non-coding DNA. I think that there's probably a lot of interesting advancements, a lot of interesting things that could happen with non-coding DNA, but this is really specific. They found that it was linked to an inherited disease. That's the part that really gets me. I think that's too much. So I'm going to say that that is the fiction along with my boys.
Okay. And Jay.
Okay. Well, the first one about the non-functioning junk DNA, I kind of like what Evan said, like, you know, then it wouldn't be junk DNA anymore, I guess. I just don't know enough about DNA to really pluck something out of there that would help. And I don't think anybody said anything other than, yeah, I just don't think so. So I'm not feeling anything good or bad was said about that one yet. This one about scientists reduce carcinogens in smoked foods, like, I don't see what the big deal is about that one. They filter something and it works better. You know, it doesn't let certain type of carcinogens get to the meat, right? And this last one about the visual auditory synesthesia, like 21% of the people that they asked, out of the three of these, this one is the fiction. I don't know why. I think that one's the fiction.
The synesthesia one?
Yeah.
Okay. So you all agree on number two, so we'll start there. By using a filter designed for car exhaust, scientists have reduced the carcinogens and improved the taste of smoked foods. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yes.
Yay.
All right, you're alive so far. So yes, they used a specific kind of filter, that a zeolite filter used in tailpipes by the auto industry. They used that on the smoke, and then they used the filtered smoke to smoke the food. And then they tested it for using spectroscopy to see like what's on there. And the carcinogenic, there was a 93% decrease in known carcinogens.
Whoa.
And on taste tests, it tasted better. So apparently the filters were filtering out the larger molecules, and the larger molecules were both, they had a negative effect on the taste, and they were also the carcinogens.
Hmm.
They said that the filtered smoked food had a more rounded, balanced flavor, while the foods with unfiltered smoke had more of an acrid or ashy taste to it.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah. So it's interesting. It's a very simple thing. It's like, yeah, let's just filter out that bad stuff. And it has turned into a win-win. And they did the taste test because they wanted to know, like Kara, are we going to be filtering out the tasty molecules, you know, the stuff that makes it taste good? But it turns out, luckily, no. Actually, at least in this study, they've improved the taste.
Great.
There wasn't just meat, because you could also filter like coconut oil, water, which then they use the water to boil things. And also cream cheese. I know they had smoked cream cheese.
Weird.
And they could use the water to brine chicken. So they did several different things, not just meat. All right, let's go to number three. In a recent survey, 21% of respondents reported experiencing visual auditory synesthesia. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And before I answer that question, I want you all to look at this animated GIF.
What the heck?
So do you hear it?
Whoa.
I don't.
No.
A lot of people do.
I hear it.
Yeah, yeah. I think I hear something.
No,
I know. I find myself saying the word boom every time it is.
Yeah.
Something
like that. No, I don't hear, actually.
I sort of hear it. Like,
I sort of hear it too.
Yep. And it's almost giving me a headache. Like I'm responding to it as if I'm hearing it. And there is this virtual kind of noise in my head, but it's obviously not the same experience as like hearing it externally. It's almost like I'm hearing it internally.
That's awesome.
Well, obviously, I
can't watch it for too long. It gives me a headache.
Oh, you're a wimp. The camera shake is important, I think.
It's the shake. Yes. Yeah,
What we're watching is a very common.
It's hilarious. Look at it. Yeah, it's hilarious.
It's three large telephone pylons, you know, playing jump rope. So the middle one is apparently jumping up and down, and when it lands on the ground, it shakes and like a giant landing on the ground, you know. And so the question is, do you hear the boom when it lands? And a lot of people say that they do.
But of course, it's a GIF, so there is no audio file attached to it.
It's silent, right? So this one is science.
Ah.
So the study was showing also, they were looking at the phenomenon specifically of visual auditory. So having an auditory component provoked by visual, purely visual stimuli. It's very common for people to hear flashes. That's a common manifestation of this. So you're right, Kara. It's more simplistic. It's not just like the more complicated things people think of, like seeing colors or whatever.
Right.
I mean, hearing colors. But it's just like there's a flash and that flash has a little auditory component to it. Or in this case, you know, your brain is kind of filling in the gaps of what it expects to hear. And they think that's the most common type of synesthesia. Synesthesia being when one sensory modality bleeds over into another, and that it's much more common than previously thought. So let me ask you a question. Have any of you guys experienced like full-on synesthesia?
No.
No, not me.
So I have. No. So that's 20% of us.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Obviously too few numbers to extrapolate from that, but it's interesting that we're 1 out of 5. Yeah, but I only get it when I'm sleep deprived, and I have the visual auditory. I have the most common type, and I do hear flashes, and I hear light, and flash. I hear movement.
Yeah. One of the core people in my like friend group, I would say maybe of 5 to 10 people at any given time, she has like legit calendar, yeah, letter number, like all that kind of synesthesia.
Yeah, that's a more complicated form. Yeah,
it's fascinating. Yeah,
right. Okay, all of this means that scientists report the first discovery of a mutation in non-functional junk DNA linked to inherited disease. That is the fiction for the reasons that you state, because then it wouldn't, of course, be junk DNA. What the study did show was the first mutation for a neurological developmental delay disorder in non-coding DNA, but the non-coding DNA was not junk DNA.
Is that introns?
It was regulatory.
Exons.
It was regulatory DNA. Not even, neither intron nor exon, but outside of a gene in a regulatory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Steve, I don't agree with how you preface this topic, because you said, yeah, because it doesn't make sense that it's being inherited in, you know, it's a disease, but it's junk DNA. My interpretation was that this is a typical like strand run of junk DNA, and some family or whatever had a mutation in it, and then and it caused an inherited disease. So when Evan said it doesn't make any sense because it's junk DNA, how could that happen? Like, well, yeah, it's junk DNA that became non-junk DNA. And
yes, that would be the way that it would have to happen. You're right that the mutation essentially turned junk DNA into a functional,
right?
Like you had a pseudo gene that became a functional gene, which is possible, probably happens evolutionarily. But damn, would that be rare?
Yeah,
that would be very rare for us to pick up on that.
Cool,
skeptical of that.
Yeah, but the trick here was the distinction between non-coding DNA and non-functional DNA.
Yeah.
There some non-coding DNA is still functional regulatory DNA. It's just not a gene. It's not coding for a protein, but it's regulating how proteins are transcribed.
There's a lot of that.
Expressed.
There's a lot of that.
And there's a lot of that. But there's still most of the non-coding DNA is legit junk. It is doing nothing. Some of it is regulatory.
So what are introns then?
So within a gene there are introns and exons, and I always thought they named these backwards because the introns are actually not the functional part. The exons are. The exons get removed and then they get combined to form the gene that gets transposed, and the introns are junk. But again, they may serve a regulatory role. They may affect the gene's expression, but they're not coded. They're not being translated into proteins. Right?
Right.
Right, but I couldn't find any evidence. And this isn't what the study was. This was just that it was in non-coding DNA, which is no biggie. Of course there are diseases associated with mutations in regulatory DNA. The only reason why they would be rare is because mutations in regulatory DNA are like fatal to the fetus, to the embryo, because they're so impactful. Those result in spontaneous abortions. So what's rare about them is that you would survive to get born with that kind of mutation. But we have discovered actually I did find other studies that did like massive surveys of families, you know, with and without genetic diseases. And if you look at like thousands of families, you do find they found hundreds of mutations in regulatory non-coding DNA. So they're not that uncommon, but you do have to do sort of big surveys to find them. So good job, guys. Jay, you went out on a limb on your own there, but
that's when you get the big wins, though, Steve.
Yeah, you have to risk a lot to win a lot. That's true.
Definitely. Yep.
Yeah, but don't forget, being first to go and still winning is a little, it's a little tougher.
On Percocet.
On Percocet.
Yeah, that's like, I think, unprecedented.
That could be, yeah.
Evan, do you have a quote for us?
I do. It gets on my nerves when people say science doesn't know everything. Science knows it doesn't know everything, otherwise it would stop. Just because science doesn't know everything doesn't mean you can fill in the gaps with whatever fairy tale appeals to you. And that was spoken by Dara O'Brien.
Yeah.
Who's a comedian and gives talks, and he's a wonderful skeptic and a champion of also science through his interviews and his talks.
Yeah, I remember him. But yeah, I saw that stand-up routine. I've actually seen it several times on YouTube. It's really good. Yeah, I remember that line. Recognize
he's excellent.
Yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, it would stop.
it's funny that you even have to say it, but you do have to say it.
Hey, guys, I'm in the poking around Discord, and they're loving the banter premium content that we released.
Yeah, I uploaded. I think I've been recording bits before the show for a couple of years now, like what we do, the talking
so
that we do.
Scary.
Yeah, it's funny.
Bob only recently found out. Right?
Bob and Kara, the one I just uploaded, has you guys talking quite a bit in there about different things.
About what things?
Oh, boy.
Unfiltered, uncensored things.
Yeah, and you can gain access to the pre-show banter bits our first level at $5 a month. So you could go to patreon.com/skepticsguide if you're interested in supporting the work that we do.
And guys, we have an update on the book. Ooh. We finally have our final cover.
Oh, awesome. Yay. Oh, yeah, I see that on Amazon.
So it will be unveiled to the world on Tuesday.
Neat.
So basically just a couple days after this show comes out. Take a look at it. If you go to Amazon and you look for The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, you'll find our book. There's actually a couple of books that have a similar title, which is true of almost anything these days.
Which are also not skeptical books, so it should be pretty apparent.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Sure, it's the one with my name in big letters on the bottom.
Yes.
You'll recognize it from it. It has the same kind of vibe and look of our logo. So yes, look for The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. You'll see our final official cover. We're really excited about it. And of course, you can pre-order it. And the pre-orders will really go a long way to helping launch the book. So we do appreciate you doing that as well. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, what a long show. Jeez.
All right, Bob. I hope you feel better.
Thank you.
Yeah, Bob.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.